All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet! Quiet!
Roll them!
Hello, and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of today and yesterday, and put it all into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online Editor-in-Chief, Rich Dries.
And seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online Contributing Editor, Natasha Bogutsky. How's it going, Natasha?
It's going great. I'm really looking forward to talking about a film of, you know, yesterday, today.
Well, a film we saw yesterday, entitled Yesterday.
I was trying to leave a little more, you know, mystery there.
Sorry,
but when I was going through our intro today, I just realized, you know, it says the films of today and yesterday, and I almost wanted to break in the song. So,
oh boy, I'm sorry, I screwed that up, didn't I?
No, not at all. Not at all. By the way,
yes.
Speaking of movie news of yesterday, let's go back about 2 years ago.
Okay.
Harvey Weinstein.
Must we?
I'm sorry.
I know.
Yes, we actually kind of need to.
Yes, he's a despicable man, and that and the things that he did should be first and foremost in our minds. About how wrong they were and the people he hurt and helping them heal. But yeah, we're movie fans, so we also know that there's also some orphaned films from all of that disaster out there.
And some of those orphaned films have found new homes with other distribution companies. One of them, the trailer for The Current War, starring Benedict Cumberbatch, Michael Shannon, Tom Holland, and Nicholas Hoult, was released this week. Now, this film's been on, what, in limbo for almost a little over 2 years?
Yeah, I think it debuted in 2017
at
Toronto, yeah. And, well, the reviews were not good or kind.
That's what I heard as well.
But, allegedly, this was an edit that Harvey Weinstein had overseen and wasn't the director's true vision. So, we're left with a question. What version are we getting when this thing finally hits theaters?
I think that makes for an interesting conversation.
True. We just don't know enough about it to you know, have a bigger conversation about it. I'm going to hazard a guess, though, because it was Martin Scorsese himself who was able to get the film back, because he has an executive producer credit on the piece. And he kind of arranged for new distribution through, it looks like, 101 Studios. And I'm guessing, especially because Scorsese's involved, that they're kind of just ejecting that Harvey Weinstein overseen cut and letting the director, Alfonso Gomez Rajon, allowing him to have his original view, vision, and cut of the film to be the one that's going to be released.
Good. But this also leaves the question, what happened to the other orphans?
Well, there was only a couple of films that were kind of like in production at that time that everything fell apart at Weinstein Company. There was a lot of projects in development. I know Sylvester Stallone had a TV series that he had in development with those guys. There was a Judy Garland biopic that evaporated, basically. Because the whole project fell through once the Weinstein Company collapsed.
But I know The Upside made it through with Bryan Cranston and Kevin Hart.
Actually, The Upside, I believe, was still just at script stage, and that got into turnaround, and somebody else picked it up. I may be wrong but on that. But yeah, that you know eventually was able to see the light of day earlier this year. Michael Moore's new documentary, Fahrenheit 11/9, was able to get released, and that's a good thing because it was very timely. That was able to find release. And he was somebody who had a relationship going back with the Weinsteins all the way back to his first film, Roger and Me, as did like Kevin Smith and Quentin Tarantino. They were both able to kind of break away from Weinstein because they didn't have anything in production at the time. You know, Tarantino, I think, was just starting to write Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, so he was lucky enough to be able to get that over to Sony Columbia. Kevin Smith, you know, just holds so much rights on his own stuff that, you know, he can take the Jay and Silent Bob characters and all the Clerks universe characters anywhere. He's already rapped on Jay and Silent Bob reboot. I'm not sure where that's coming out from, but, you know, he's continuing on making work. What else was there? There's another film called War with Grandpa that was sitting around. It was originally scheduled for release in April of 2017, and it starred Oakes Feigley from Wonderstruck and Robert De Niro as his grandfather. And apparently, they get into a practical joke war with each other. And Uma Thurman and Christopher Walken co-star in this thing. And
what?
It's,
I need to see this.
I know. It sounds crazy. And it's just kind of sitting around somewhere on a shelf.
My Tarantino inside me needs to see this.
You know, unfortunately, I think the real people, you know, and I'm sure these films will come out. The real people who were hurt were the ones who had screenplays and scripts in development that just they weren't able to take anywhere else. I mean, they got paid, but they would have gotten paid a lot more if those projects got into production.
That is true.
So, you know, that's unfortunate. And, you know, but like I said before, though, you know, that unfortunateness is of secondary import when we think about, you know, the whole reason why everything went wrong with Harvey Weinstein and the numerous, numerous victims of his. But.
Yes.
Let's move along to something only marginally less downbeat. We're about halfway through the summer now.
No!
I know.
Yes.
You're thinking, it's barely July 4th.
Hey.
Halfway through the summer?
I've already started listening to Christmas music. Okay?
I know. Well, you would have started listening to Christmas music on February 24th if your husband allowed it. So.
Hey. No, it's not whether or not he allows it, because I can listen to it in the car all I want. I have a moral thing about not listening. I can't listen to Christmas music until July 25th.
And yet.
I broke.
Yes. Yes, you did. But.
So I'm happy the summer is almost over. It means fall's coming. It means we're closer to Christmas.
Oh,
but
boy.
Fall. Leaves. Cool weather and Halloween.
That's true. But anyways, halfway through summer, because summer now begins in the beginning of May, according to the movie seasons, and runs May through August. So we are technically right at the midpoint there, as June is changing into July as we speak. And boy, oh boy, has the summer movie season been a bit of a bust.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
I would, actually. Oh. I really haven't seen a lot of movies this summer that impressed me.
All the big stuff has been almost always franchise films so far. Obviously, Avengers, which did great. Mm-hmm. Avengers is kind of like the exception to what we're going to be talking about here.
I think that's what happened is everyone got burned out on Avengers, that they didn't have anything left for anything else.
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of non-superhero-y franchises that, you know, people certainly could have gone to, but didn't want to for whatever reason. You had things like, you know, Men in Black 4, Toy Story 4. I'm just trying to think here. I'm pulling up my Letterboxd to see what I've seen this summer. And honestly, the best things I've seen were like smaller films that, you know, did okay. Actually, Late Night. The Mindy Kaling comedy did very well. I mean, it was made for not a whole lot of money. So it was relatively easy to turn a profit on that. I liked it. I didn't love it, you know, but I liked it. It was nice. It was nice and inoffensive enough and an enjoyable hour and 45 minutes in the theater. And we both really liked Dead Don't Die from last week. But how many franchise films comes out? Summer is like a monstrously huge franchise film. Right now, we've had Godzilla. We've had...
I liked Godzilla.
Shaft. We've had Child's Play. Toy Story. It seems like virtually every week we're getting a film that's part of a franchise. And I don't mind that. I mean, I like franchise films. Especially, you know, when they try to expand their storytelling in ways the way like Marvel has done over the last 10 years. You know, and build and seed things and let things play out. But a lot of these have just been disappointments at the box office and honestly, a bit of a dud, you know, for me, critically, even. I didn't really like Men in Black International all that much. I wanted to. I think you, we both know how I feel about Shaft after episode 42, where we talked about it.
Yeah, we could not come to terms. Mm-hmm. So we're moving on past that one because we'll get back into it.
I liked Plus One, which was another romantic comedy that's not a studio romantic comedy. It's an indie romantic comedy.
That was at Tribeca, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was at Tribeca, but it got its theatrical run earlier this month. So that's why I'm gonna throwing it in with summer movies. But then again, it didn't get a big, you know, 4,000 screen release or anything like that. So not a lot of people saw it, and people will probably catch up with it somewhere on home video or streaming or what have you, and that's fine. Another indie comedy, indie rom-com, really, that I caught on streaming was Always Be My Maybe, the Ali Wong, and I really liked that. I thought that was a lot of fun. And, you know, that's where, you know, the tropes are kind of the same as a regular rom-com. But, you know, the performances kind of really carry those films. If you really want to see a good comedy that goofs on rom-com formula, I would suggest tracking down from a couple years ago a film called They Came Together.
I'm not familiar with that one.
It's some of the guys from the States. So it was David Wayne, Michael Ian Black. In addition, you have Paul Rudd in there, Amy Poehler, Bill Hader, Ellie Kemper, Colby Smulders.
Of course.
Jason Mantzoukas, Randall Park, who's also in Always Be My Maybe. Christopher Maloney, who, of course, knows those State guys from Wet Hot American Summer. So Ed Helms. It's just it's an insane cast. And it barely got a release. I think that movie escaped more so than was released. And it was a great little thing that just kind of goofed on romantic comedies. And that's one of those ones I was like, I wish more people knew about. Outside of Anna, which I didn't like really all that much, and Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I can't think of another big film this summer that is, you know, that's original and not based on a property or a spinoff or a sequel or reboot or anything like that. Can you?
No, I can't actually. A lot of, and you and I have talked about this before, franchise names sell tickets.
True.
But it feels like this summer they haven't been.
Yeah. And now is that a case of people are just tired of franchise films, which I don't believe. In general, I don't believe that. They might be tired of certain franchises. Nobody was really clamoring for Men in Black to come back.
Not without Will Smith.
Especially without Will Smith. But, you know, on paper at least, you know, we saw Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson together in Thor Ragnarok, and they were a lot of fun. So, yeah, sure, let's pair them up somewhere else. And there was just no chemistry there. And it was...
Which is weird.
Yeah, it was not a good film. The only other thing I can think of really off the top of my head is Midsommar.
I am looking forward to Midsommar. As you and I both know, I tried to sit down and rewatch Hereditary, which came out about the same time last year, which is an odd time of the year to release a horror movie. I hate you right now. I hate you. Oh, I should have saw that freaking coming. But no, I didn't see that coming, just like I didn't see the poll coming.
Oh. Yikes.
For those of you who've seen Hereditary.
If you haven't seen Hereditary, go see it, listen to this again, and guarantee you it's 10 times funnier than what you're thinking right now.
Yes. It will either be funny or it will be cringeworthy. Either way, you'll probably laugh.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking, you know, at the rest of the summer schedule. Okay. Later on in July, we have Stuber, an action comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Which looks like it could be fun, but I don't see either Dave Bautista or Camille Nanjiani opening a movie based on their names.
No,
that's got a hard marketing trail ahead of it. Also that weekend, Crawl, the alligator horror film that I remember sitting next to you in a theater, and when the trailer came on, you curled up into a ball and you were just like, not having this.
No, I think I curled more up into a ball for the trailer following it, which was Child's Play.
Yes, that's true. And then on the 19th of July, we've got Lion King.
That will sell.
Yeah. August 2nd, Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Shaw. That's going to probably do decent business, but franchise.
Yeah.
And then August 9th, a drama from Fox called The Art of Racing in the Rain, which I really don't know too much about outside of seeing the one standee at the one local theater.
I don't know much about it either.
The Dora the Explorer movie.
No, that will fail like the Kim Possible one did.
Ooh, ouch. Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark will probably do good.
That will decent. Yeah.
The Kitchen, which is the one I'm looking forward to.
I really hope that does good.
I just actually picked up the 8-issue comic book miniseries that it's based on this past weekend. And I am
a little worried, though, because it doesn't look, as you and I both know, I mentioned the other day off mic that The Kitchen seems, it had that feel to me of inspired by a true story.
Mm-hmm.
You noticed Scorsese's shots in the trailer.
Yes.
It doesn't feel like a comic book property.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a drama. It's going to be interesting to try to put that forward and say, hey, this is a comic book property, when it's not being marketed as such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the rest of August, which is the dog days of August for a couple of reasons, most likely because of what they dump into the theaters, you've got 47 Meters Down, Uncaged. Sequel to a, oh my God, I'm going to get eaten by a shark movie. Some comedy called Good Boys. A crime drama, The Informer. That comedy drama, Where'd You Go, Bernadette?
I think Good Boys might do good money for a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it actually does look kind of interesting.
Oh, what's catching your eye there? I mean, it's Jacob Tremblay. Oh, yeah, that's the one with the three or four kids. I don't know, man. It looks like a sex comedy for, like, preteens. And instead of getting laid, it's just getting a kiss. Which I guess is okay, but you've really got to skate carefully on what kind of tropes from your average teen sex comedy you use. Otherwise it could be really creepy.
If I'm not mistaken, it's the same people who brought us Superbad, right?
Yeah. So.
Yeah. So it's going to have, I think, they'll be able to play it interesting.
Okay. It will be interesting to see once that comes out.
And after Booksmart just came out
Booksmart, yeah, another great film, small indie budget, did really well financially, but I still wish a lot more people had seen it because I thought it was a fantastic and wonderful film. It's probably one of my favorite films of the summer so far.
And that also has that Superbad feel to it.
Well, yeah. And not just because one of the leads is Jonah Hill's sister either. You didn't know
that's
that?
That's why she looked familiar.
Yeah, and then later on in August, there's the Angry Birds movie 2. Also, Blinded by the Light, which is about somebody living in England who discovers Bruce Springsteen's music very early on, and it's based on a true story. And it got a lot of word of mouth out of Sundance. So I'm anxious to see that. That's actually getting a wide release from Warners. So that's interesting.
I'm just looking forward to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That will probably be the end of my summer right there. So we've got Spider-Man coming up and they're in midsummer. And I'm pretty certain Once Upon a Time in Hollywood's going to finish off the summer.
So I'm just going to have to drag you to stuff for the rest of the summer so we have something to talk about.
Pretty much.
You don't want to talk about Angel Has Fallen?
No.
Ugh.
Like I saw the others.
Honestly, I think White House Down was the better of the two White House being invaded by terrorist movies. Because that movie made absolutely no bones about, yes, we are a diehard ripoff and we are going to lean super hard into that curve. I totally respect that movie for just saying, yep, this is beat for beat Die Hard, but it's not an office tower. It's the White House. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And we're going to put our hero in a wife beater, white T-shirt, and we're going to do this, and we're going to try to have an attempted escape in a limo, and that's not going to work. And then we're going to have this, and then we're going to blow stuff up. It's White House Down is Die Hard in the White House, and there's no getting around it. Olympus Has Fallen tries to dress it up and tries to distance itself from what it obviously is and seems like it wants to be better than what it obviously is. And that's why I really don't like Olympus Has Fallen, then London Has Fallen, and now Angel Has Fallen. Don't care.
And on that note.
Yes.
There is one little bit more of news that I want to talk about because it's just really awesome. And this will make you a happy person.
Okay.
Someone was slimed this past week.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Go ahead.
Paul Rudd has been added to the cast of Jason Reitman's Ghostbusters 3.
You couldn't have picked a more perfect cast member.
No. I mean, well, going back before the Paul Feig version happened, when Dan Aykroyd was still trying to develop a third Ghostbusters film, which would have seen the original cast handing over the business to some newcomers and then serving kind of like in an advisory mentor role.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Rudd's name was one of the names that kept kind of bubbling up and down in actors that were rumored to being thought about as possibly being in this, you know, along with like Ben Stiller and Chris Rock and a bunch of others. So when it was announced earlier this past week, that, you know, he was joining the cast, I was like, well, yeah, that makes perfect sense. It seemed almost inevitable in hindsight that he would join the cast.
And him with Finn Wolfhard, I think, is going to be really interesting. Mm-hmm. Finn of Stranger Things fame is famously known in season two, where they all dressed as Ghostbusters.
That's true. Wasn't that one of the first promotional pictures released for the season?
Yes, so, it was.
For when they were at Halloween. So,
I think that's going to be a little fun bit of, just a little bit of fun. Kind of poking out there.
Definitely.
I don't know where my words went.
That's okay. It's only a podcast. We go take a moment to go look for Natasha's words. We'll be right back.
They're around here somewhere.
I know. They probably fell behind the couch again.
Probably.
So we'll be right back in just a few moments with a couple of trailers that dropped this week.
Baby, don't make
I think women can do anything.
Just because they can doesn't mean they should.
But I have so many talents. It's like I'm powerful
with a little tender. Oh, you're right.
I'm just a decoy, Stan. That's just the way
you make me feel. Who steals? You manage your AKA money.
Outstanding angels.
You have a new client?
Who is she?
I can't sleep at night.
I'm the lead programmer on a product that can revolutionize the power industry, but there is a possibility it can be weaponized.
Elena, we need to go.
You know
no. I'm bringing
bombs. You're not
a waitress?
No, I'm Jane.
Oh.
Who are you?
I'm Bosley.
Welcome to the Townsend Agency. We exist because traditional law enforcement can't keep up.
I don't like that, boy.
You guys are like lady spies. Jane's former MI6.
Oh, God.
What did you do to Sven?
I compressed his carotid and deoxygenated his brainstem.
Well, that sounds painful.
Don't worry. He's going to wake up.
Unless he doesn't. Sabina runs the ground game.
See, I know stuff.
Let's get the weapon before it becomes every bad guy's favorite new toy. Take her to the closet, gear her up.
We're gonna need some wigs, toys,
feisty
clothes.
Ah, we're still in the first closet.
There's another closet.
Oh my God.
Oh, Vince.
Let's just stop the touching. Some of these blows up.
I'm really excited for this.
This being
Charlie's Angels.
From Elizabeth Banks.
Yes.
Writer, director, and co-star. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Banks.
There
triple
is
threat. I like it.
Well, she's always been a triple threat.
True.
And I like that over the past few years, she's finally getting recognition for that.
Mm-hmm.
One downside.
Yes.
If that is the single that they've created for this film, Destiny's Child still schools you. Sorry.
Okay, so you're saying that's about the only good thing to come out of the two other Charlie's Angels movies from 2000 and 2003.
Bernie Mac.
Directed by Mick G. Yeah, Bernie Mac was fun.
And Lucy Liu.
Yeah, they just weren't good movies, though.
No, they weren't.
Mick G is one of those horrible directors I just don't like, because he's a lot more style over any kind of substance whatsoever.
They were fun. They weren't great.
He's the Zack Snyder of Mick G's.
I didn't know there was more than one Mick G.
I'm just... Sure, why not? I'm interested in this. It looks like they've kind of tweaked the concept of what the Townsend Agency, the group that the Angels work for, kind of tweaked that concept a little bit, made them international spies or something like that. I don't know, but I kind of like that, because back in the old days on the TV series, they were just private detectives. You know, they're former police officers who wanted to do good for people because they couldn't in their jobs. So despite the fact that the original TV series was kind of written off by a lot of critics as a jiggle show, for obvious reasons, it at least had a layer of empowerment in its concept that we know we can't succeed because of glass ceilings in the 1970s, early 80s. At our jobs as police officers, so we're going to go work for this private detective agency where we can blossom and use our full talents. And I like that idea. And I'm hoping we'll see that here in this movie as well.
This movie has one hell of a cast, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the trailer, we see Patrick Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
Who else is in here?
Oh, well, obviously Elizabeth Banks, mm-hmm. Kristen Stewart.
Yes.
Naomi Scott of recent Aladdin fame, who mm-hmm. played Jasmine. Oh, God. His name always drives me crazy. Jaimon Hanotsu? Is that correct?
Digimon. Oh, yeah. I can't do that right. Yeah, I know who you mean. Sorry.
Actually, they have him listed also as playing Bosley.
Yeah, which makes me think that Bosley is a title for the various offices around the world in this this version of Charlie's Angels.
We also have Sam Claflin.
Mm-hmm.
And recent up-and-comer Noah Centineo from a lot of the Netflix original movies, such as The Kissing Booth
and
a few others.
Okay, cool.
He's the one playing the handsome nerd. Phosphorus. Mm-hmm.
Sounds good. Great cast. Looking forward to that. Again, it's a franchise. People know it. Is that enough to bring people in? I think they know enough, and it's been rebooted at least one time successfully, financially successfully. Critically, I don't know. You know, before, by Mick G, as we just said. So I think this is actually one that people might really want to kind of come see.
Yeah, I mean, it
still has a bit of a...
The name still has recognition.
Yeah. I think, you know, obviously people aren't going to go to Charlie's Angels and be disappointed that they're not seeing Cheryl Ladd and Farrah Fawcett Major or anything like that.
No.
They don't expect that. But they know, oh, new Charlie's Angels film? Three women kicking ass. Okay, I'm in.
And I'm...
If that's the kind of thing you want to see on a Friday or Saturday night, you know, people are going to come to the theater.
I still think that the Cameron Diaz, Drew Barrymore, Lucy Liu, McGee Fest, as you like to call it, is still rather recent in everyone's memories, that when it comes to name recognition of Charlie's Angels, Farrah Fawcett is not where they go to first.
I think there might be a generational divide.
And that's the problem.
That. Yeah.
That's the problem we have to run into.
Yeah.
For those who live through the era of Farrah Fawcett, that mm-hmm. is where they associate that. But for the generation that I live in, we didn't grow up with that. We didn't know that that was Charlie's Angels. Charlie's Angels for us, if we were lucky and we caught it as a kid, was the Mick G triplets, as I like to call them.
The Mick G triplets.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a singing group on Lawrence Welk. And now it's time for the lovely Mick G triplets.
The Mick G?
The Mick G triplets, and they're going to sing Don't Sit Under That Apple Tree. Sorry. I just went off on a weird tangent. I apologize.
No, it's all right. But we remember, you know, three hot women in black kicking ass.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think there is going to be a little bit of, okay, I remember that. So if this is anywhere close to that, I'm going to see it.
Honestly, when when I think, and I don't do it very often at all, when I think of McGee's two Charlie's Angels films, I think how they're the inspiration for Kevin Smith's Bandits in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Oh, God. Why am I not surprised?
Well,
it actually makes sense.
He's totally riffing that.
Yeah.
But let's move on from a film, you know, definitely targeted at people who have remembrances of this franchise and filled with very young people, to a film that looks like it's probably targeted towards maybe older audiences, cast filled mostly with older actors, distinguished actors.
Older, distinguished.
Yes.
English actors.
English actors. Well, I thought distinguished covered that as well. And it's not based on any kind of franchise. Here's our first look at the upcoming The Good Liar.
So tell me, have you done this a lot? Met people on the computer service? Don't you find it's always the same?
You mean the anticipation followed by the letdown? And I tell myself, brace up, this time it will be different. Which is why I must now confess to you a deception on my part. My name is in fact not Brian, it's Roy.
To the future.
How much do you think she's worth?
Nearly £3 million.
You didn't take the lot?
You bloody bet I'm going to take it all. Is that your grandson?
It's too soon to be getting so close to him.
I've grown very fond of you.
Do you know who you are? You're the only person on this planet who makes me feel that I'm not alone.
I know things about you, who you really are.
You don't want to do this, Roy. It's the game. It's the adrenaline rush. What if it is?
Seems like you've had quite a past.
Well, well, well. Ian McKellen, Helen Mirren, Jim Carter, and Russell Tovey in a thriller directed by Bill Condon. Where the fuck do I sign up?
I hate to say it, you're going to have to wait till November.
No!
Yes! Sorry. That was a few moments from The Good Liar, the first trailer for which dropped this week. And, ooh, I like it. I love a good, you know, con man story. And I think that at the heart is what this is hinting that this is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But, whoosh, once you throw in some of the acting talent like this at it.
Yeah.
You know, that's just kind of definitely just jumped to the top of my films to watch for in the fall.
I'm really happy. As much as we're seeing Ian McKellen and Helen Mirren, who are extremely seasoned actors and very distinguished in their field, that Jim Carter and Russell Tovey are getting a little more recognition. I think they are amazing actors who, until recent years, haven't really been given a lot. Mm-hmm. To really bring them into the spotlight. They have, and they're widely respected in England, but they're not really known over here. Russell Tovey, which you may have seen in an episode of Doctor Who or an episode of Sherlock, Hounds of the Baskerville,
yep.
Is more known for the British television show Being Human, about a vampire, a werewolf, and a ghost living together. Which was actually turned into an American show on Sci-Fi, which wasn't as good.
Well, yeah.
And he does, his stage work is just quite the list. Mm-hmm. Jim Carter has been working for almost at least 20 years. I first saw him when I was a kid in the movie called The Little Vampire.
Oh, gee.
With Jonathan Lipnicki.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard of it, not seen it, and...
It was
probably never will.
It was a fun, cute movie when I was a kid with Richard E. Grant and Alice Krieg as well. So I just couldn't pass it up.
I guess.
And very, very young Ian DeKestecker. Playing one of Jonathan's bully friends.
Ah.
Now he is widely known for Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So thank you very much for giving him something worthy of his talents.
Indeed. So, yeah, this looks fantastic. fingers crossed that it will be fantastic. And we'll be right back in just a few moments with our review for this week. A look at the new Danny Boyle film, Yesterday.
Yes.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it seems as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
John, Paul, George and Ringo, the Beatles.
Which Beatles? Is this the insect Beatles or the car Beatles?
The pop group Beatles. Nick, help me out here.
Right, yes. There's this problem with musicians. They presume everyone else has this encyclopedic knowledge of obscure pop, in this case, the Beatles.
Wow, this is the most complicated joke I've ever heard.
It's a very nice
song. It's not a very nice song, Nick. It's one of the greatest songs ever written.
Well, it's not Coldplay. It's not Fix You.
It's not bloody Fix You, Carol. It's a great, great work of art.
Wow. Somebody suddenly got very cocky.
There is no denying that the Beatles made an indelible impact on culture around the world. And from the first time they frolicked across the big screen in Richard Lester's A Hard Day's Night in 1964, the movies were forever changed by those four lads from Liverpool as well. As much as the Beatles' music has become interwoven in everyone's lives, filmmakers have been using their songs to evoke a variety of different feelings and emotions. Whether it be the joyous party vibe of Matthew Broderick lip-syncing to Twist and Shout on top of a parade float in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, or the dark irony of Michael Moore's use of Happiness is a Warm Gun in his documentary Bowling for Columbine, or the poignant orchestral version of Hey Jude in Wes Anderson's The Royal Tenenbaums, the universality of the music provides a convenient shorthand to help connect viewers more deeply with the scene in question. But what if the Beatles never existed? That's the situation struggling musician Jack Malik finds himself in when, after being in an accident right at the moment of a worldwide blackout, he discovers he is the only person on Earth who remembers the music of the Fab Four. When he tentatively tries to pass off a few of the Beatles' songs as his own, he is randomly discovered by pop star Ed Sheeran, who thrusts Jack onto a path that sees virtual overnight success, plus all the problems that such immediate fame can bring. So, Natasha.
Yes.
Do you buy the world that is shown to us in the movie of where there's no Beatles music whatsoever, except for what Jack remembers?
What do you mean by that?
It seems to me, and this is the issue I had with the movie going in, that the Beatles are so fundamentally a part of our culture now, after 50-some years, almost 60 years, that to remove them out of time like the way the movie does, we would see much larger changes, I think, than what we see in the film. I mean, yeah, there's a couple of jokes like Oasis doesn't exist anymore.
I lost it laughing.
Which, yeah, got me very much too, you know, because they're often described as, you know, just a new version of the Beatles. But there's other things in the world. Coca-Cola doesn't exist.
Harry Potter doesn't exist.
Harry Potter doesn't exist. Cigarettes don't exist. How do you go from taking Beatles out of time to cigarettes, which obviously predate the Beatles by a couple of centuries? How do you take that and not have them exist? I'm not sure I understand, like, the mechanism that caused that.
I think I came up with a theory last night when trying to think about that. It's one of the most popular things of each category. Coke is universally the most popular soda pop out there.
Okay.
Cigarettes are pretty much in a category of all their own, but they're up there in tobacco products, such as cigars, pipes.
We didn't see any kind of tobacco products, and I wish they kind of just pushed a little bit further on that, because if no tobacco products exist in this world, then what drove colonization of the U.S.? You see how dramatically history would veer off on a different direction? But this world, and obviously because Jack travels to Los Angeles, this world is supposed to be very much like our own with just a couple of these minor differences.
Who says that tobacco and colonization of the U.S. still didn't happen? Because at the time, cigars and pipe tobacco were more popular than cigarettes.
True, but we don't see any type of smoking in this at all. No one smokes. And not just like because cigarettes don't exist. And that's why I wanted a little bit more clarification from the movie. Does all tobacco products not exist in this world? Or is it just cigarettes? And if cigars still exist, how come no one ever had the thought to go from cigar down to something smaller like a cigarette?
And then as for Harry Potter, easily probably the most popular book saga of all time. And I know the Tolkien in you wants to fight back.
I'd have to see sales figures. I know. The Tolkien fan in me is like, meow.
But I would.
Current fame is fleeting. You know, I would have to give Potter existing for at least a decade or two more before I would want to draw a serious comparison in terms of popularity and longevity between J.K. Rowling and J.R.R. Tolkien. Outside of the fact that, yes, they both have initials that start, you know, with J. And I was thinking about this, too, last night after we saw the film. My thought was more of, because we're dwelling on the fact that Beatles music disappear out of this movie, out of this world.
Mm-hmm.
Except for one person who remembers it. My thought was, what if that's just one of the side effects to one of the other things that disappear. Suppose somebody found a magic wish machine and decided to get rid of cigarettes because they knew somebody who died of lung cancer or something like that. Or somebody wished away to the cornfield Coca-Cola because they had a loved one die of diabetes or something like that. And the fact that the Beatles don't exist anymore is a byproduct of that other wish. And the only reason we're thinking about it in the other way is because we're focusing on the one guy who remembers the Beatles in this story. And so we're kind of like off on the side story from whatever else was actually the originator of this thing. I mean, the movie doesn't get into this at all.
I like that because it leaves for conversation. What happened?
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, because it gives it a fairy tale quality and a little bit of a magical realism quality, or a lot of a magical realism quality. But at the same time, part of me is like Richard Curtis, the screenwriter, hopefully had it all worked out in his head why this was happening, even if he doesn't tell us. To just say it doesn't matter kind of doesn't give any kind of bedrock underneath to any of the rules of the world as they play out, and then therefore the rules are just arbitrary based on what he needs the script to do. And I kind of push back against that kind of writing.
I thought about it too. Rolling Stones mm-hmm. still exist. So who started
the British invasion?
Yeah, pretty much.
I don't know. I mean, that's, again, something, you know, my music-loving side of me is like, well, do the Dave Clark Five exist? Does Herman Hermits exist? Does, you know, the numerous other Manchester bands, Liverpool bands that all came out of England and just flooded into America, does Paul Revere and the Raiders exist? And if we don't have the song Hooked on a Feeling, do we have a decent Guardians of the Galaxy movie? There's a lot of dominoes that start to tumble over once you push that first one that says the Beatles don't exist.
Yeah.
And I think they want to keep the world semi-recognizable without just a few small changes that, you know, kind of once every now and then remind you that, oh yeah, you know, other changes happen too. But I think honestly, the Beatles are so part of culture that, like I said, once you flick that first domino, a whole lot of things are falling from that. Mm-hmm. And you can't just make the joke about Oasis not existing anymore. I mean, when I was freelancing for a local newspaper, I interviewed a lot of local, regional, and even national music acts. And one of the things, you know, just kind of a standard question is, you know, okay, what are some of your influences? And you talk about, you know, things that inform their music. I can't think of anybody who didn't say the Beatles, first and foremost.
It's kind of universal at this point.
Exactly. At this point, it's so hard to make the jump to this movie's place, for me at least, based on, you know, my own experiences. So that was the baggage I had going into this movie. And I'm thinking something similar for you or not?
Not going into it. I think I realized it more while watching it.
Okay.
The one thing that bothered me is the two characters, Jack and Ellie. He says that what kind of jump started him believing he could be a musician and her believing that he could be a musician was when they were, in second grade, he did a half-decent performance of Oasis's Wonderwall.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene is kind of very important to not the story, their story.
Yes.
It's kind of the moment where they became friends and have been friends ever since.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Beatles never existed, Oasis never existed, which means he never performed Wonderwall.
How do they become friends? Exactly.
Yeah.
It's...
Unless, at this point, that song is now an original to her.
True, but I don't think they ever mention, they don't even, you know, kind of explore that thing,
no.
You know, which is basically a standard time travel grandfather paradox.
Because if it was now considered to be an original to her, that would make more sense as to why she had such faith in him.
Mm-hmm.
You're thinking about it now, aren't you?
Yeah, I am a bit, but I'm also thinking that at this point, we should, I guess the theme song from Mystery Science Theater advises us, you know, stop thinking about these scientific facts and we should really just relax.
And just enjoy it.
And just enjoy the movie. And on that level, did you enjoy the movie?
I did. I believe I mentioned it to you earlier. I said, this is what is known as a bad day film, or mm-hmm. as you like to call it, a comfort movie.
Yes, as we talked
when
about last week.
When you are feeling just down and out, this is the type of movie that you would put on in order to make you feel better about mm-hmm. yourself and about the world and give you some sort of semblance of hope, because that's kind of, in a way, what this is. I was listening to the Beatles on the way over here to record the podcast this mm-hmm. morning, and I kind of came to the realization that a world without the Beatles is not a world that I would like to live in, because their music is just so perfect.
There's probably a Beatles song for every mood and moment in your life.
Yes,
just about.
There is.
And, you know, again, that's why I spoke, you know, briefly to their universality in the intro to our review here. And because of that, that's why directors constantly use Beatles songs in their shows. I mean, even going back to, late 60s on the BBC series The Prisoner, the Patrick McGoohan series, that cult classic. If you're not familiar with it, folks, run out and watch it. It's only 16 episodes. And in the last episode, which gets very allegorical and very weird, the song All You Need Is Love is an important part of that. And I think that might be the first time Beatles music was used as a storytelling element, not just here's the Beatles on Ed Sullivan kind of a thing.
And Richard Curtis himself has used the Beatles at certain moments in his mm-hmm. previous films. Love Actually, within the first 10 minutes of the movie, there's a wonderful scene where Keira Knightley is getting married to Italia Jafor's character. And a whole brass band stands up and starts playing. And this is out of the the attendees at their wedding.
Mm-hmm.
They start standing up and playing All You Need Is Love with someone up on the balcony singing it. And it was a very Jim Henson's Funeral type of scene.
Yeah, it's a
but
very...
more cheerful.
Yes.
And it was perfect.
Joy through the suffering.
Yeah,
sorrow.
Yeah. The song could not be more perfect for that moment.
Yeah, and damn you for mentioning Jim Henson's Funeral, because now I'm thinking about Kermit singing Rainbow Connection at that, and that just bums me right out. I mean, it's so beautiful, and
Richard Curtis has said that was his inspiration for that scene.
Oh, wow. Okay, I did not know that.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, good. I'm okay. We're good. We're good. Keep going.
And if we didn't have that, we also never had the film Across the Universe.
I know, and I don't want to live in a world without that movie.
No, I can't. I can't. My girlfriend and I went to Virginia last week, and we did a concert to the entire soundtrack all the way down.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's just so much out there that we could not do without the Beatles being part of.
Again, it's like, okay, here's the analogy of taking the Beatles out of pop culture, and then we'll kind of get into the substance of the film itself. Imagine pop culture is one big giant Jenga pile. To remove the Beatles, you're taking one block out, but you're using a sledgehammer to do it, and you're taking the block at the base out. And you're just going smash, and everything falls apart, because that's what happens. You can't remove the Beatles out without changing too many, without changing a whole lot of things. But anyhow, so we have this world where Jack wakes up. He's the only one who knows the Beatles songs. He's desperately trying to remember all of them and all the lyrics and making sure he gets it right, which leads to some funny moments because everybody, when they try to remember songs, will screw up lyrics or be like, oh, wait, no, isn't there a thing where they talk about, you know? So that part I really liked. And it wants to be sarcastic or have something, you know, sarcastic or witty to say about the music industry in general.
Kate McKinnon.
Yeah, especially through Kate McKinnon's character.
She's a shark in this.
But yeah, but I don't think it plays right. It feels like she's in a slightly different movie. She feels much more, I mean, she's a shark, yeah. And she is basically just very, you know, ruthless in her manner and very, I'm telling you the truth, and it's a harsh truth. But the way she plays it, it feels more like a Saturday Night Live sketch character than an actual character. And every other character seems very much more grounded in the reality of that world. And she kind of feels just a little not so grounded in the reality of that world.
Well, that's just Kate McKinnon, you know, letting a little bit of her seep on through. Every role that she plays has a little bit of that in it. But I think there's a scene where she offers him the chalice of money and fame and power.
The cursed chalice.
The cursed chalice.
Yes, because I actually jotted that line down. I really liked that.
And yes, she is playing almost like an SNL character. But you know what she kind of reminds me of?
Hmm.
Or what that scene reminds me of?
Hmm.
The deal with the devil.
Oh, yeah.
Like supernatural style crossroads demon.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is what I am giving you. What can you give me in return? And I can look past the SNL mannerism at that moment, because there is something in the actor playing Jack in his face that scares me.
How so?
And there is a look of, I'm in over my head, but I can't stop. It's almost like an addiction at that moment when he says, give me the chalice.
Hmm.
Now you kind of want to go back and just rewatch that scene.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking about that. And yeah, I mean, that's probably nothing I'm going to, you know, I probably won't go back to this movie until long after it's come out on video.
Yeah.
Because honestly, I don't think the romance subplot balances well with everything else. It just kind of seems to like disappear for a while, then comes back and disappears. And I would have liked more of them struggling through his fame together. And then once they're apart, it just feels like it wasn't a co-storyline with the main storyline of him being thrust into this fame. It always felt like it just pops up just to be a complication, and that's it. There's nothing complimentary about it as well.
Well, here's the thing that I realize.
Hmm.
Having a relationship like that, or starting a relationship like that when you are the most famous, greatest musician at the time, it is probably more difficult to get a relationship started than it is to keep one that you already had prior to it. Unless the person is famous or a celebrity, and that's why we see a lot of celebrity couples together, mm-hmm. is because there isn't that complication of, I'm just a school teacher, I'm just a normal person.
Yeah, but
and you're up there on the pedestal.
20 years of friendship and hiding their romantic feelings for each other, you know, as a baseline.
But that doesn't matter, because once you go from friendship to the love, if that screws up, you've got nowhere to go. You can't go back. And therefore, if you're going to make it work, you've got to be able to commit to making it work, which is why, you know, she threw down the line of, I can't do a one night stand.
Yeah.
Because she knows that the moment they do, if it doesn't work, which it probably won't, because he's leaving tomorrow morning mm-hmm. back to L.A.,
and I think
it ruins everything.
Unfortunately, and I'm sitting there going, okay, the perfect line here, if you really mean it and you weren't afraid of that relationship, would have been, it doesn't have to be. And the whole third act kind of turns on that one moment where he can't confront his own feelings for her. And
what? It doesn't have to be a one night stand?
Yeah. He could have just said, she could have said, I don't want this to be a one night stand. And then he just, a moment of emotion. It doesn't have to be. And
he does say it doesn't have to be. And she goes, when are you leaving? And he says, tomorrow. She goes, that's the definition of a one-night stand.
Then doesn't she realize that maybe he's asking her to be part of his life and to come along with him?
But she can't, because one of them has to give up something.
True. She would have to give up her job. But at least saying, we are committed to trying to make this work. And for right now, I understand that you have this commitment to your job. I have this commitment to my new job. And we're still going to make it work. So we're going to start here today and try to make this work. Even if it's long distance relationship for a little while or bouncing back and forth via Concorde or whatever, you know, between two continents. You know, it just seems like they were afraid to kind of put that work into it.
Because
that was frustrating because I was like, dude.
Because a lot of times it doesn't work out. When you say a long distance relationship, how many times do they really work out?
It depends on if you know that the distance is only going to be there for a while or not, I think.
But she didn't know that, neither did he. You're betting on a crystal ball at that moment.
Yeah.
And I mean, that 20 years of friendship is something that is...
They weren't even willing to kind of have that discussion any further than, you know, than say, well, what if we did this? And I was kind of like, guys, you know, you're in your mid-20s at least here. I think they're kind of pushing 30-ish. You know, to me, it was like, you should really be, you know, of an emotional intelligence enough to say, okay, how would we make this work? Can we at least think about what we'd be able to do this if we were to go ahead? And they didn't.
Because they didn't want to risk what they already had.
Yeah. But even then, I mean, you know, you can still have that conversation and then go, okay, you know what? This would probably be bad in the long term for us, and I prefer us to stay the way we are. And
but then
the movie
already
doesn't give them that.
But then you've
discussion.
Already confronted the fact that, no, you actually do want to be a couple. And that alone is enough to destroy the friendship, because there will always be that awkwardness.
Not necessarily. I don't think so.
I guess it just is subjective based off a couple.
It could be, yeah.
Sometimes it does, mm-hmm.
And maybe they were afraid that it would change things if they even discussed it. So, you know, I could see that, but it was kind of a frustrating thing for me. It was like, come on, guys. So maybe I was rooting for them to get together all along then, and I was perhaps more invested in the movie than I thought I was. But from a storytelling standpoint, though, I still think that the relationship issues pop up only as additional complication to his life. There's never anything where they help him, and until the very pat resolution of everything at the end.
All right, I guess I can sort of see that.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you have?
That's really it, though. I mean, I liked the movie. I wasn't in love with it. I wasn't raving about it. There wasn't like things that just jumped out at me as like, oh my goodness, this was awful. So maybe because it's Danny Boyle, I was expecting a little bit better.
There were definitely some Danny Boyle moments that I could tell in, mm-hmm. in the stylization of the film.
A great supporting cast. I had to chuckle that Jack's parents were played by Meera Syal and Sanjeev Bhaskar. who were the two stars of a series called The Patels at number 42.
Which is funny because the actor...
Where they played husband and wife.
Yeah, but the main, the actor playing Jack, his last name is Patel.
Mm-hmm. But that show was basic. It was a talk show slash sitcom where basically one of the people was an aspiring talk show host. So rather than actually having a talk show, he would invite guests over to his house to and chat with them there. And then there was like a studio audience. It was very kind of weird and surreal and British. And Comedy Central, I think it was, ran it a few, you know, several years back when it was on. But it was fun. And so it was kind of nice to see that those two together as a husband and wife again.
Sarah Lancaster shows up in this briefly.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish they'd given her more to do because I love Sarah Lancaster and I don't think she gets enough credit. She was marvelous in Wuthering Heights playing the role of Nellie Ellen. Mm-hmm.
I think her character, though, is very important to to a certain part of the movie. And it's a small role and it's one of the really nice feints that the movie does. I don't want to just, you know, give it anything more away, but when her character and another character start to show up, you start thinking one thing and the movie kind of doesn't dissuade you of what you're probably thinking. And then once those two characters meet with Jack, things go in a different way. And I liked that they did that. I really did. And I don't want to get into spoilers, but I kind of thought that, you know, eventually how the movie ends with what Jack does kind of flies in the face of that meeting between the three a little bit earlier. But that's fine.
I think it was a nice little nod
mm-hmm.
to finally do that at the end. But also make it, I'm dancing around spoilers.
I know.
It's so difficult right now.
There's a few things you don't want to spoil in this movie.
But it was a nice little also slap to the music industry. Mm-hmm. And I really like that.
Yes.
Because instead of, you know, taking fame and money and power and everything for them or for him, he does what he does.
I want to give it up to the couple of actors who played Jack's group of friends back in his hometown who would come out to his shows and supported him. Even though when his music career was going nowhere and they were pretty much like his only audiences at certain places, they all felt really, there was a great chemistry there between all of the other three actors there. And you really felt like these people had all known each other for years, you know, whether it was in the writing, whether it was in the casting or some magical alchemy between those things, they were really good together. I really enjoyed that. But I'm going to ask you.
Yes.
As the fan here.
Mm-hmm. I know where you're going with this.
How is Ed Sheeran's acting?
Not bad. He had some good comedic timing at some points that I appreciated. He wasn't all that bad. A lot of times in his filmography, he's always played himself, whether that be, Bridget Jones' Baby or Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping.
Which you really need to see because that's hilarious.
I've heard. And even in this, he is playing himself.
Yeah.
I'd like to see, you know, some more stuff of him not playing himself.
Mm-hmm.
Because back in 2015, he did a TV show called The Bastard Executioner. And as a Sheerio, yes, I watched it.
Sheerio?
That's actually the...
Like Jesus.
The Cumbers or whatever, where the Cheerios. Shut up. Shut up.
Ugh, moving on.
And it was a very short-lived TV show. It was only on for 10 episodes, one season. And he was on 5 of them. And he played a sadistic clergyman. And this takes place during like the medieval like crusades.
Mm-hmm.
There were moments where... Yeah, I could see through the character, but a lot of times he was having some fun with it. And that's what I want to see more of him doing. It's not so much playing himself. He's got some good raw talent there, but he's not being given enough to do with it. And yeah, he's the biggest musician in the world right now, which makes it a little difficult for him to do any sort of acting at all. But guys should think about it, you know, broadening his horizons. I mean, we got Queen Latifah, Common, Justin Timberlake, for God's sake, can do it. So can Ed Sheeran.
Mm-hmm. One last thing I want to comment on was, obviously, this movie is wall-to-wall Beatles songs.
Yeah.
There's still an orchestral score for certain scenes, and it very much mimics late period Beatles music. The scene leading up to the minute and a half leading up to Jack's accident where he gets hit by a bus while he's biking. Mm-hmm. It kind of very much builds up, you know, very, very similar to things you've heard in the Beatles, but it still manages to be its own thing. And I really liked how that all worked together like that.
But I think that just about wraps us up for this week.
Now remember, you can find us online at bigpicturepod.com. And we are now available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So either use the link in the show notes post, or head directly there, search, and hit subscribe.
And if you like what you're hearing, leave a positive review, because that always helps us connect with new listeners. We'll be back next week with more movie talk, news analysis, and a review of Spider-Man Far From Home.
And that's all here on the Big Picture Podcast.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it seems as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday.